Today is Wednesday, March the 20th, 2024. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key. Big Tech has been collecting and aggregating your personal data. Do you know and do you care how big tech companies are using your personal data? We have been bringing computer news, hardware and software reviews, guest interviews, and news of user group meetings for the past 40-plus years. The Personal Computer Show is a 3-time winner of the prestigious National Computer Press Awards. Our only advocacies are consumerism and the First Amendment. I welcome you, the listeners, to provide feedback as to what you want to hear. Address your suggestions to Hank at PCRadioShow.org. Our website is PCRadioShow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network, which is www.prn.live, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.live on the Internet. You can leave us a message with your question or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. The FCC officially raises the minimum broadband from 25 megabits per second to 100 megabits per second. The FCC quadrupled the download speed required to market internet as broadband. ISPs now have to offer 100 megabits per second down and 20 megabits per second uploads on their services. The commission also sets a long-term goal of raising the broadband metric to 1 gigabits per second downloads and 500 megabits per second for uploads. The FCC has raised the speeds required to describe internet service as broadband for the first time since 2015. The agency's annual high-speed internet assessment concluded that 100 megabits per second downloads and 20 megabits per second uploads would be the new standard. This is unwelcome news, as ISPs would prefer to keep pointing to 25 megabits per second and 3 megabits per second speeds, the previous standards, and convincing people they're getting high-speed broadband. The FCC's report broke down several areas where the country's online infrastructure falls short. The agency concluded that broadband isn't being deployed quickly enough to serve Americans, especially those in rural areas and those living on tribal lands. These gaps in deployment are not closing rapidly enough, the agency wrote in its report. More specifically, the agency said fixed terrestrial broadband service, not including satellite, has yet to be deployed to around 24 million Americans, including about 28% of people in rural areas and over 23% of those living on tribal lands. On the mobile front, it added that about 9% of Americans, including 36% in rural areas and over 20% on tribal lands, lack adequate 5G cellular speeds of at least 35 megabits per second down and 3 megabits per second up. The report set a long-term goal of broadband speeds of 1 gigabits per second down and 500 megabits per second up to give stakeholders a collective goal towards which to strive. Those numbers may hint at where the commission would like to move the goalposts the next time it updates them. In 2015, when the commission set the 25 megabits per second up and 35 megabits per second down requirements, FCC Chair Jessica Rosenworcel commented, "Frankly, it should be 100 megabits per second, the benchmark the agency finally moved to today, 9 years later." The FCC cannot police ISPs or force them to boost their speeds. What it can do is prevent them from marketing their services as broadband internet if they don't meet these thresholds. It remains to be seen whether the companies providing the infrastructure will comply. "This fix is overdue," said FCC Chair, who added, "It also helps us better identify the extent to which low-income neighborhoods and rural communities are underserved. Raising the speed metric is important because it helps the commission determine which areas in the country are receiving adequate internet speeds and if more government funding is necessary." In 2015, the FCC raised the metric from 4 megabits per second and 1 megabits per second to 25 megabits per second and 3 megabits per second. But since then, U.S. senators, government watchdogs, and FCC officials have urged the commission to raise the metric even higher, citing the U.S. growing reliance on internet service and apps. According to FCC data from December 2022, an estimated 45 million Americans lack access to both 100 and 20 megabits per second fixed service and 35 and 3 megabits per second mobile 5G service. As part of the vote, the FCC also adopted a long-term goal of raising its broadband metric to 1 gigabits per second for downloads and 500 megabits per second for uploads. Millions of people in rural, urban, and tribal communities still do not have the broadband they need to fully participate in modern life. Microsoft Copilot is offering GPT-4 Turbo for free. Until now, the advanced artificial intelligence model powering Copilot's Pro tier wasn't free to all. Microsoft's advanced GPT model is now available for all to use for free. Microsoft Copilot, the tech giant's artificial intelligence assistant, has upgraded its free tier, GPT-4 Turbo. The OpenAI model that powers Copilot Pro is now available if you use Copilot free. To access GPT-4 Turbo, you need to set Copilot to either creative or precise mode. If you subscribe to Copilot Pro, you'll still have access to the GPT-4 Turbo model by default, but Microsoft Advertising and Web Services CEO said in a post on X, which was formerly Twitter, that those users can switch to older models if they choose. For free users of Copilot in creative mode, GPT-4 Turbo is now powering that experience. A Microsoft spokesperson confirmed in a statement, Copilot Pro users remain able to toggle GPT-4 Turbo on or off in creative mode. GPT-4 Turbo has been trained on data up to April of 2023 and can also handle text-to-speech prompts, and its context window can accept 128,000 tokens, the highest amount offered in a GPT version. Tokens are pieces of words. The more tokens a model can accept, the more text a user can input into the model to provide additional context and get a better result. Microsoft launched Copilot last year to add AI across its platforms. The AI assistant is available online and is also baked into Windows 11, the Bing search engine, Microsoft 365, and the Edge browser. Copilot's Pro tier costs $20 per month and adds extra AI-powered features in Office apps, along with priority access to new OpenAI models and enhanced image creation tools. Every tech company under the sun is finding ways to fold generative AI into its products, spurred by the arrival of OpenAI's ChatGPT chatbot in late 2022. Google is experimenting with integrating AI into search, and Samsung launched the Galaxy S24 smartphone earlier this year with a host of AI features. Apple has yet to announce a generative AI product, but has said it sees a huge opportunity and is excited about what's in store for us for the rest of the year. OpenAI, meanwhile, is now letting users build special-purpose AI apps, and its AI chatbot rivals from Google Gemini to Anthropic's Claude continue to upgrade their offerings. Is GPT 4.5 Turbo coming next? It's unclear why Microsoft decided to bring GPT 4 Turbo to its free Copilot tier. Microsoft intentionally offered a more capable AI model in Copilot Pro to attract users to the paid version. By offering the same model in both the free and premium tier, those who would only subscribe to Copilot Pro for the better GPT option may otherwise stick to the free version. That said, Microsoft's decision could also be a tell. OpenAI is rumored to be working on a new model called GPT 4.5 Turbo. Although the company has been tight-lipped on future GPT iterations, Reddit users discovered earlier this week that OpenAI mistakenly published a blog post saying GPT 4.5 Turbo surpasses GPT 4 Turbo in speed, accuracy, and scalability. While that blog post was quickly removed from the OpenAI website, it would suggest an upgraded GPT model is coming soon. It would also suggest if Microsoft indeed wants to differentiate its Copilot versions by offering the better model in its paid tier, that the company might be planning to bring GPT 4.5 Turbo to Copilot Pro if and when the new model launches. Where are Android's AirTags? An AirTag is a small device that uses Bluetooth technology for location tracking in case your items are lost or misplaced. Android is overdue a significant upgrade to the Find My Device network, which would bring Bluetooth proximity tracking and compatibility with third-party Bluetooth trackers. However, this rollout was and continues to be held up by Apple's delay in adopting the specification for unwanted tracker alerts. Apple still not added unwanted tracker alerts to iOS and iPhones, despite the spec being available in December of 2023. At Google I/O 2023, Google announced a significant upgrade to Android's Find My Device network. Android devices will soon be able to locate nearby Android devices via Bluetooth proximity, and the network would also be open up to third-party Bluetooth trackers, aka Android's AirTag equivalents. The result would be that Android's Find My Device network would become as powerful as Apple's Find My network, and inarguably even more due to Android's global popularity. But the announcement was made close to a year ago, and we're clearly not there yet. If you're wondering where to pin the blame for the delay, we have one clear answer: Apple. Google shared an update in July of 2023 that the Find My Device network launch was delayed until Apple has implemented protections for iOS. More specifically, Google is working in partnership with Apple to help finalize the joint unwanted tracker alert specification by the end of this year. This primarily was in reference to the threat Apple users would face if any of the then upcoming Android-compatible Bluetooth trackers were used for nefarious stalking purposes. iPhone users would have no way to identify these trackers that aren't part of Apple's Find My network unless you spot the tracker physically, so it made sense that both Google and Apple acted responsibly. However, the timeline has gone by, and Android's Find My Device network upgrade is still nowhere to be found. What's the holdup now? Unsurprisingly, the answer is still the same: Apple. A report from Android Police sheds more light on the situation. The specification that Google and Apple are working on is called Detecting Unwanted Location Trackers, which is undergoing a lengthy and extensive process to become an internet standard. Apple's implementation of unwanted tracker alerts would be based on this specification. But it wasn't clear if Apple was waiting for the specification to become an internet standard. Such a move would take many more months, and it wouldn't be before July of next year, 2025, that at least a standards document would be submitted, and Apple could move forward. The report notes that Google has clarified that what Apple was actually waiting for was a production implementation of the specification for unwanted tracking alerts instead of an actual finalized version of the specification. This production implementation was published in December of last year, 2023, and the integration version of the standard is available. Apple has had what it needs to implement unwanted tracker alerts on iOS for a few months, but it hasn't yet done so. When Apple will implement unwanted tracker alert is unknown. Apple was contacted for more information, and will we hear any update? If we are allowed to take a guess, there is a good chance that this spec gets implemented in iOS 18, which is first expected to be announced at the Worldwide Development Conference 2024, presumably in June of this year, 2024, and then rolled out in the stable branch when the iPhone 16 get announced, presumptively in September of this year, 2024. Apple's delay is holding up the rollout of Android's Find My Device feature. If Google did go ahead and upgrade the network before Apple implemented unwanted tracker alerts, then Apple users would be the ones at grave privacy and security risk. Unfortunately, Google's responsible delay is hurting Android users as they have to spend more time without such a crucial feature. So the next time you lose your Android phone, you can blame Apple for being unable to find it. Now, if I can only have a device with Find My Device for eyeglasses, I don't know how it would be attached to eyeglasses, but that would be a major product for me. The FCC is cracking down on cable junk fees. The Federal Communications Commission adopted new rules requiring cable and satellite television providers to clearly display their all-in prices as part of effort to crack down on so-called junk fees. Under the new rules, providers will have to include the total cost of video programming, including any additional programming-related fees, in promotional materials and bills. No one likes surprises on their bill, FCC Chair Jessica Rosenworcel said in a statement. The advertised price for a service should be the price you pay when your bill arrives. It shouldn't include a bunch of unexpected junk fees that are separate from the top-line price you were told when you sign up. It's not just annoying. It makes it hard for consumers to compare services in a market that is evolving and has so many new ways to watch, she added. According to the agency, between 24% and 33% of consumer bills for cable and satellite television come from additional fees such as broadcast TV fees, regional sports surcharges, and HD technology fees. The bottom line is we do not have to have junk fees, Rosenworcel said. We can have bills that are transparent and fair. This is a step in that direction, and that is good news for consumers. However, NCTA, a trade association that represents cable programmers and providers, argued that providers already offer clear and accurate pricing information to subscribers, including all-in pricing information. Today's misguided action will not help consumers and will only add confusion from government-imposed ad requirements, NCTA said in a statement. Are they kidding? Voyager 1 sputters back to life. Late last year, NASA's Voyager 1 spacecraft, which has been traveling through space since launching almost 50 years ago, started sending nonsensical messages back to Earth. But now, according to NASA's latest update, the Voyager mission team has spotted a sign of life in the form of a signal that turned out to be readout of the memory of the aging spacecraft's flight data subsystem, an onboard computer that readies packets of data to be transmitted to Earth. The data wasn't in the proper format, but at least it was something. So while there are no guarantees, it's a hopeful sign of life that could allow Voyager 1 to continue its decades-long mission. The memory contains a wealth of data about Voyager 1 status, including science or engineering data. The engineers are now comparing the data to the previous readout to figure out if there are any discrepancies that could explain why the spacecraft has been acting so strangely. The team is analyzing the readout and are using that information to devise a potential solution. An attempt to put it into action will take time. The ancient spacecraft has already been through many challenging times, from dwindling power supplies and grimy thrusters to near-fatal software glitches. Despite the many hurdles, scientists are still trying to squeeze every bit of life that may or may not be left. Effectively, the core between the spacecraft and Earth was still connected, but Voyager's voice was replaced with a monotonous dial tone. The source of the issue appears to be one of Voyager's three onboard computers, the flight data subsystem. This computer, NASA says, is responsible for packaging science and engineering data before it's sent to Earth by the spacecraft's telemetry modulation unit. and engineer at NASA's Deep Space Network, which is tasked with operating radio antennas that communicate with Voyager 1 and its interstellar sibling, Voyager 2, was able to decode the outlier signal, discovering that it contained a readout of the flight data system's entire memory. The team will now compare this new signal to data that was sent back to Earth just before Voyager 1 started spouting binary nonsense. Finding discrepancies will help the crew hunt for the source of the issue. The idea is to try using different sequences in its software package and determine if the communication issue could be resolved by navigating around a corrupted or damaged section. Voyager 1 is currently around 15 billion miles from Earth, meaning that solving communication issues can be a painstaking process. It takes 22 and a half hours to receive a radio signal from Voyager 1, then another 22 and a half hours to receive a response via the Deep Space Network's antennas. That means the results received on March the 3rd and on March the 7th, engineers started working to decode the signal. 3 days later, they determined the signal contained flight data subsystem memory readout. NASA scientists and engineers will continue to analyze this readout to restore communication with a pioneering space mission that extended humanity's reach beyond the solar system. NASA's engineers have renewed hope now to fix Hubble Voyager 1 after interstellar space data outage. NASA's engineers are acting as detectives to resolve a communication issue with the Voyager 1 spacecraft. One of the space agency's 46-year-old twin spacecraft zooming through interstellar space. Troubleshooting an issue with a spacecraft traveling through interstellar space is complicated. It takes about 22 and a half hours for a message from Earth to reach the spacecraft and another 22 and a half hours for a response back to Earth. The Voyagers were also constructed before the digital age. This combination make the problem-solving effort multifaceted. Circuit diagrams for the computers are posted in a room at JPL, that's a Jet Propulsion Lab, covered with sticky notes as engineers search through paper notes and contact retired Voyager engineers. About once a week, a team of engineers sit down and think about what we can try next. After carefully creating and checking the plan, a command or a poke is sent to Voyagers in hopes of fixing the corrupted section of the computer. Then they wait 2 days to find out if it worked. NASA shared hopeful news that Voyager team saw different activity on one section of the flight data subsystem, but still not in the correct format. However, an engineer with NASA's Deep Space Network, a network of radio antennas to communicate with Voyagers and other spacecraft, was able to decode the signal and discovered a readout of the entire flight data subsystem memory. This could be what Voyager's engineering team needs to get the spacecraft to speak the correct language again. The flight data subsystem memory includes its code or instructions for what to do, as well as variables or values used in the code that can change based on commands or the spacecraft status. It also contains science or engineering data for downlink. The team will compare this readout to the one that came down before the issue arose and look for discrepancy in the code and the variables to potentially find the source of the ongoing issue. This isn't the first scare for either spacecraft. Another issue with garbled data for Voyager 1 in 2022 was fixed over several months. In 1981, the team experienced a similar communication issue to the current problem. Last year, an incorrect command sent Voyager 2 pointing away from Earth, unable to send data back. Teams were able to send a patch and reorient the spacecraft. The Voyager team are used to bumps on this long road. However, it's worth it because the twin interstellar explorers are still collecting valuable data. It's just really an amazing story to think that two spacecraft are still operating after 46 years and having basically flown through the outer solar system. The entire heliosphere across the heliopause now on out into interstellar space. With the latest clue in this case, Voyager engineers are devising the next plan of action to help the spacecraft start sending back the data from 15 billion miles from Earth. Presenting the IT Pro Series with Benjamin Rockwell.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. This is where we talk about computers, the workplace, and a lot of the different things that happen. Brandon reached out. I've been promoted over a team that is fully remote. What guidance can you give regarding effectively managing a remote team? So some of these things that I'm going to talk about do involve technology. First off, though, you have to set clear expectations, and you have to work on this on a regular basis. Whether we're talking about tasks and deadlines or goals, whatever it is, you need to clearly communicate those to your team. You also need to be aware of that work-life balance. You have to respect the idea that you may be in the middle of a Teams, Zoom, whatever webcam meeting, and people will be interrupted in their homes. That the boundaries are changed, and people all have to have a different set of expectations than we used to. And that's fine. That still is a good thing. Of course, you want to have open communication with everybody, and you want to provide support. But let's talk about more of that technological side of this. And this is all going to be some of the experiences that I've had over the course of all of these COVID years of working via remote. First off, and this is being done well in some companies, being done better in others, worse in some of the others as well. But leverage collaboration tools. And you may have some of these at your disposal. You may have a platform for communication, that instant messaging communication like Teams or Slack. And it doesn't matter whichever platform it is. And you want to leverage those. Forget to utilize. You want to leverage those as best you can. So that means being very responsive, being very communicative, and also not being afraid to lift up the handset, if you will, and dialing into people. So I will reach out to a lot of people during the course of the day when I'm working, and a lot of what I have to do is communicate a variety of technical issues over to the various people at the company I work for. So I'm communicating those, and yes, I utilize Teams. That's the program that we utilize where I work. And I will reach out to them with a lot of different details, but I always finish this off. Look, we can get together and talk about this. And I do this in a variety of different ways. Feel free to reach out to me if you have questions. And I always tell people, look, my calendar is 100% up to date. Set a 15-minute phone call with me, and I'm more than happy to explain all of this. And then we need to start working on what are we doing with collaboration for files. Okay, so whether we're dealing with SharePoint or we're dealing with Google file sharing or Dropbox, we need to make sure that all of the files that we're working with on a team are accessible by everybody. Yes, there's going to be certain things which you're going to store away, you know, the performance reviews of the employees and things like that. But everybody should have access to the same project files that everybody else does. So you want to make sure that everybody's working on the same files, on the same page, and so forth. And then you want to work with some level of project management if you're in that realm. So there are a variety of different project management tools across many of the companies. If you don't have one, look into – there's a program I've used for project management around my house called Trello. It's a beautiful program, and it doesn't matter which of these you're dealing with. It's just a matter of taking it to that next step and doing that. The idea of those project management tools and keeping track of progress and holding regular meetings is important. And where I work, we're doing that as well. The last item is find ways to promote team bonding. And this is virtual team building activities. This is opening up some of the team meetings with icebreakers, with fun little questionnaires, or fun things like, hey, what is the name of your animal, your pet rather, and the rest of the team has to guess whether it's a cat or a dog or a fish or an iguana or whatever it is. And that was one we just had a week ago. And it was so funny. Everybody had a blast and it opened everything up. And this is all in the realm of a related item of making sure you have some level of a virtual water cooler. And this is where everybody gets together and they do some level of non-work related items. But what happens is these conversations open people up. They foster a brand new level of team bonding, something that we don't necessarily get a whole lot when we're in person, not at least to this level. But there's this camaraderie where everybody really starts to have fun. And you basically put it forward as an idea of, look, we're here to work. But you know what? We spend a good portion of our day doing this, so there's no problem with us smiling, getting along, and just building up brand new relationships that may be 1,000, 2,000 miles apart from each other. At least they'll be memorable. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. If you recently had gotten a new cell phone, you may wonder what you may be able to do with your old phone. Well, you can turn the old iPhone or Android smartphone into a home security camera. Free software can transform your old phone into a basic home security camera. It might not be your primary phone anymore, but it still probably has got a good camera. If you're upgrading to the new iPhone or Google Pixel or Galaxy phone, what would you do with your old phone? Well, you can donate it, recycle it, or sell it. But you could also use it to set up a free security cam. One of the ways to repurpose an old phone is to convert it into a home security camera. It's an excellent cost-effective alternative for your old phone to keep an eye on your home when you're not there. And setting up a smartphone as a security camera isn't hard at all. In fact, you can start using that time-worn phone to keep your home safe. The first step is to install a security camera app on your old smartphone. To begin, you would need to choose a security camera app. Most apps offer many of the same features, such as local streaming, cloud streaming, recording and storing footage locally or remotely, and motion detection and alerts. Once you've been set up, you will be able to monitor your living space and control your security camera from anywhere, straight from your new phone. One of the best app options for setting up your phone as a security camera is Alfred, A-L-F-R-E-D. It's cross-platform, so it doesn't matter if your old phone was an Android phone or iPhone, and the same goes for your new phone. Alfred is free to use and give you a remote view of your live feed, motion detection with alerts, free cloud storage, a two-way audio feed, and use of both the front and rear cameras. To unlock additional features like higher resolution viewing and recording, zoom capabilities, ad removal, and 30-day cloud storage, you can upgrade to Alfred Premium. If you have multiple old phones lying around, you can set up multiple cameras for fairly robust video coverage. And you got to remember to mount or position the camera and a small smartphone tripod such as the Joby Gorilla Pod phone tripod or suction cup car mount can work wonders and help you position the camera in an inconspicuous place. To broaden the field of view, you might want to consider buying a wide-angle lens for your phone. streaming video is very power intensive, and the phone will be on 24/7. To keep the phone from dying in the first few hours, you will need to position it close to a power source. A 10-foot micro USB or lightning cable will give you more flexibility in where you put it. And that's it. Now you can use the security cam app on your new phone to view the feed from your old phone's camera. And you've made your home more secure without spending much more money. What is computational photography? Computational photography refers to the use of digital image capture and processing techniques that rely on digital computation instead of traditional optical processes. It involves the use of software algorithms to enhance or process images taken from cameras, particularly in smartphones. This approach extends the capabilities of digital photography, allowing for the creation of photographs that could not have been taken by a traditional camera. Computational photography encompasses a range of image post-processing techniques, and it has significantly contributed to the improvement of smartphone camera capabilities over the last decade. One of the key aspects of computational photography is its ability to simulate optical phenomena, such as bokeh, through the use of depth mapping technology and algorithms. Additionally, it has enabled the proliferation of advanced methods like high dynamic range, such as the HDR imaging, which intelligently merges multiple exposures to capture a broader range of tones and colors in a single image. The use of computational photography has revolutionized the field of photography, particularly in the context of smartphone cameras, by leveraging software and machine learning to enhance and extend the capabilities of image capture and processing. There are the varying approaches of camera manufacturers towards computational photography. While some manufacturers like Olympus OM System have heavily invested in computational photography features, others like Panasonic have expressed reservations about its relevance to their target market. The reluctance of some brands to fully embrace computational photography may stem from factors such as the perceived preferences of their customer base and potential legal limitations. It is interesting to note that computational photography does not necessarily have to replace traditional image capture in standalone cameras, providing users with the choice to utilize these features. The considerations and decisions made by camera manufacturers regarding computational photography can shed light on the future direction of this technology in the photographic industry. Intel will be the first to use backside power delivery in a process node. Okay, what is backside power delivery? In a recent interview, Intel CEO Pat Gelsinger didn't mince words when speaking about the importance of the upcoming Intel 18A process node, which Microsoft and other foundry customers will use, saying, "I bet the whole company on 18A. Intel's 18A and 20A manufacturing technologies will introduce power via or power VIA backside power delivery. Power via solves the growing issues of interconnect bottlenecks in area scaling by moving power routing to the backside of a wafer. Intel takes on backside power delivery is called power via. Traditionally, the tiny wires used to deliver power to a chip have sat on top of all the layers that make up modern semiconductor. This was fine in the past, but as chip technology has advanced, this approach has reached its limit. The wires that deliver power end up competing with the wires that connect components, creating a mess that wastes power and leads to lower efficiency. Power via moves the power interconnects to the backside of the chip, removing this conflict. The company has said that this change enables a 6% increase in clock speed, which translates into higher performance. This performance gain is on top of the performance benefit gained from moving to a more advanced process node. The technology which Intel will use with its upcoming Intel 20A and Intel 18A process nodes can provide performance and efficiency boosts. Intel will be about a year ahead of TSMC, providing its foundry business with a critical advantage as it aims to steal market share. Intel will leap ahead of the competition with a critical new technology. TSMC dominates the semiconductor foundry market, and Samsung is in a distant second place position. Well over 50% of global foundry revenue is generated by TSMC, as the company has a significant manufacturing lead over its rivals. Chip designers like Apple and Nvidia have little choice but to choose TSMC to maximize performance and efficiency of their chips. Intel and its foundry business generates little in the way of revenue, but the chip giant is starting to make plenty of noise. The company now has $15 billion worth of deals locked down, spread across manufacturing and advanced packaging. Notably, Intel recently scored Microsoft as a customer for an unnamed future chip. Intel expects the Intel 18A process to top TSMC's best in terms of performance and efficiency, capping an incredible turnaround that will see 5 process nodes launch in 4 years. Intel 18A is still on track to be ready for volume production by the end of the year. While Intel offers other manufacturing processes through its foundry, Intel 18A will be the star of the show. A deal with ARM Holdings will optimize the process for ARM-based chips, opening the door for Intel to manufacture chips for smartphones, servers, and everything in between. The Intel 18A process will also be used by the U.S. Department of Defense as part of the effort to bring critical chip manufacturing to U.S. soil. While the Intel 18A process will deliver plenty of performance and efficiency improvements over Intel's current manufacturing tech on its own, one critical technology will help it stand above the competition from TSMC and Samsung. Intel will be the first foundry to offer backside power delivery, a huge deal for customers seeking high-performance, power-efficient chips. PowerVia will actually debut with Intel's 20A process, which will be used for the company's Arrow Lake PC chips later this year. Intel 18A will then improve on the Intel 20A and be available to foundry customers in 2025. Intel will be about a year ahead of TSMC in implementing backside power delivery, giving the Intel 18A process a critical advantage as it ramps up production next year. TSMC is expected to introduce the technology in its own N2P process node, which won't be coming until sometime in 2026. Meanwhile, Samsung is reportedly racing to implement the technology. Reports indicate that the company is moving up its plans to use backside power delivery in a process node due to launch sometime in 2025, although this hasn't been confirmed by Samsung. Regardless, Intel will still be the first to market with the technology. Intel is playing catch-up in semiconductor manufacturing after rampant delays in the past enabled TSMC to pull ahead. For the first time in a long time, Intel will beat TSMC to the punch with a critical new technology. The company has already won over Microsoft, and more major customer wins are likely in the cards as Intel 18A, boosted by backside power delivery, nears completion. Presenting Technology Chatter with Benjamin Rockwell and Marty Winston.
Marty said, I want to do an unboxing segment.
Which really means we're dealing with stuff I've still got in the cart as it arrived or in the box as it arrived. And I haven't written it up, so we'll wing it. And you can be the Word document I type everything into. Sure. You'll hear it fresh out of my stuttering mouth.
There you go. All right. So you've got all kinds of stuff here. That's tools.
Yeah, a lot of tool stuff. I'm holding a 12-volt cordless 5.5-inch rotary saw from Skill.
Nice.
And I am so impressed with this. It's got a lot of the usual safety features that rotary, we did a segment on this, that rotary saws should have. But one of the nice things about this is it has two handles for you. One in the hand grip where the trigger is to start and stop the saw, and one just forward of that. And as long as your hands are on both handles, you can't cut yourself.
Very, very true.
At least you can't cut your hand or arm. I don't know what you're doing with your legs at the time.
I notice you don't have a blade in there. You've got some of the plastic protectors are still on there too.
I mean, no,
this is fresh out of the box.
Yeah, this plastic protector that you're seeing.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Part of what you use later, it rolls back as you're cutting something.
Yeah.
So less of the blade is exposed. It's one of the safeguards that. I was really impressed with how many safeguards are native to every skill circular saw, but we've got a couple of more stops to make. And you and I both get Klein tools on occasion.
Yes, yes.
And I want to go over some that I recently got. The highest tech ones are new mini cross line laser levels.
Okay, yes, I saw those. I was considering whether or not I wanted to ask for those. I'm glad that you saw those. Okay.
So, yeah, and I've got – they sent two, one red and one green. They arrived at the same time.
Yeah, all right. So let's dive into this. These are used for all kinds of leveling.
Yeah, and they cast lines on your workspace. So, for example, if you're nailing vertical studs up, they really are vertical. If you're putting a ceiling frame up, they go where they need to go. These things are self-leveling because of the way levels usually work. And the laser lines are bright, highly precise, and there are a lot of mounting margins. So in the workspace, they make easy happen. It's the best thing I can say about them.
Yes.
Klein also packaged up a bunch of stuff to go with each other. This is their digital multi-tester DMM, which stands for digital multimeter, with receptacle tester. There is an AC power cord in here.
Okay.
That mates with...
Hold it up just a little bit higher. So,
it mates with the jacks on the front.
Okay.
So you can check what is at an outlet.
Uh-huh.
So you're
not plugging in the test leads anymore. You're just plugging in your standard three prong.
Yes, exactly right. Yeah.
So that'll give you your voltage readouts. That'll give you your
resistance and continuity on wiring.
Yeah, yeah.
And you can also find GFCIs that are miswired. You can there's a find mode that will help you locate the breaker that corresponds to an outlet.
Oh, nice. Yes.
And because everybody needs this, it can perform tests on your 1.5-volt and 9-volt batteries.
Love that. So it's really packaging a lot of the practical.
Yes.
Into that. This is kind of bridging an interesting gap where normally we think of Klein as being a little bit more of that higher end contractor level. And this looks like this is great for the family. This is mom needs her own multimeter to test all of the stuff out.
Well, I have to tell you.
And no offense to mom. Moms everywhere.
No offense to contractors. This is fully contractor level stuff.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
But go to Home Depot. Take a look.
Exactly. What exactly is the name on that again?
The Digital Multi-Tester DMM with Receptacle Tester, ET270.
Any idea on the price on that?
Haven't looked.
Okay.
Sorry.
That's okay. That's fine.
Also still on the card, the Klein Tools Digital Angle Gauge with Angle Alert. This is the digital version of a level.
Yes, yes, I love that, and it can tell you. I can see, it's set up to tell you the exact angle. We're talking a matter of 118.1 degrees, or something like that.
And you can set a zero for relative angle measurements.
Okay,
if you go away from it, it's got alarm lights and a buzzer. The reverse contrast display is easier to read no matter what the lighting is.
Mm-hmm.
And it has magnets on the bottom. So, for example, if you're dealing with pipe.
Sure,
and you're trying to maintain a 2 degree or whatever it is slope on the thing, 2 inches per foot, I think it is, that slope.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, you're there. I'm sorry. The magnets are on one side. The opposite side is grooved. to go on a round pipe.
Nice. Yes, yes. Beautiful. And is that magnets that there as well to hold it to the pipe? I couldn't tell.
I don't think so. I think it's lights there. Again,
okay.
Hey, folks, this is still on the blister pack.
Yeah,
haven't pulled it out yet.
This was a box opening, but it was actually the big, huge UPS box that came on in. As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell, and that's Marty Winston.
Thank you, Benjamin, and thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Computer Club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and the Connecticut tri-state region. Log on to the club website for more information on remote meeting ID. The Brookdale Computer Users Group has a meeting Thursday, March the 28th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and the topic of presentation is, what is an AIPC? Online virtual meeting, and their website is bcug.com. TED Ed Connect meets Thursday, April the 4th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., online virtual meeting via Zoom. Website is wpcug.org. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets Friday, April the 5th. Meeting time is 8 p.m., and it's an online virtual meeting via Jitsi. Website is acgnj.org. The Kings Bight Computer Club meets Tuesday, April the 9th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. at the Park Plaza Restaurant, located at 220 Cadman Plaza West in Brooklyn. The phone number to call for more information is 347-278-7320. The New York Amateur Computer Club has a meeting Thursday, April the 11th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., online virtual meeting via Zoom, and the website is nyacc.org. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, April the 12th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., online virtual meeting via Zoom, and the website is limac.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN, live streaming on the Internet. Podcast of the program is available on prn.live on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Michael Horowitz, Benjamin Rockwell, and Marty Winston, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.